Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm Caroline.
And I'm Anna.
And this is Seriously, the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman.
Hello.
Hello.
Welcome back to Seriously. We're in London, as you may all know, probably, and it's starting to get pretty Christmassy. What's that? I was going to say the song line. It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas.
Yeah, it is. You walk around town and lots of pubs have like painted their windows with festive designs.
Yeah, there's one on our road, isn't it? Mm. That looks well good in the window.
And also people seem to be doing a lot more just drinking in the middle of the day, which is another sign that Christmas is nearly here.
Yeah, and also I find now that if I go to the pub for a drink, I end up getting like really drunk really quickly because I'm just like, I don't want to go outside.
Yeah, exactly.
I'll just stay here forever.
It's warm in here. I need to have another drink so I can stay in here.
Exactly. Yeah. But it looks really beautiful everywhere. Like the lights in London and stuff's really nice. And we work next to St. Paul's and like St. Paul's looks amazing. So yeah, have you been doing any Christmassy activities? I've done a few. I have a friend whose birthday is in late November and she's obsessed with Christmas. So every year her birthday sort of marks the beginning of Christmas for us. So this year for her birthday, we had loads of people around to the flat and we made like mulled wine and spiced rum. And we all sat on the floor of our like tiny living room slash kitchen, you know, like next to the dishwasher in the crumbs with like loads of blankets. We made like mince pies. We also then made goat cheese and onion tarts using the mince pie pastry. So they were a bit sweet.
Bit sweet.
And candy canes. We had like a whole proper like festive feast and we all sat and drank and ate and watched Elf and it was like the perfect start to my Christmas feelings.
That sounds lovely. At the moment I'm finding the whole concept of Christmas quite stressful because I sing in various choirs and stuff. So Christmas is a very busy time for me on that front. I do a lot of like charity concerts and, you know, corporate Christmas do's and stuff like that. Mm. There's a lot of like learning to sing terrible arrangements of Jingle Bells because that's what JP Morgan want for their Christmas do and things that I do at this time of year,
oh,
which
God.
Kind of stresses me out. But it's always really nice on the night, like when you're there at this big fancy Christmas party and like everyone's having a lovely time and looks really nice and you're providing the happy music for it.
Yeah,
but
that sounds lovely.
It's just like being in a cold church at 10 p.m. on a Wednesday night and having our conductor be like, that was okay, but can you sing Jingle Bells again, because I just didn't believe you.
Once more with feeling.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Oh, bless. What are you in the choir?
I sing alto.
Ah, yeah, I would have had you down as an alto,
yeah.
I think. Oh, in the spirit of the season, the greatest gift that you could give to us listeners, we thought would come in the form of an iTunes review.
Lots of you email and tweet us and stuff to say lovely things about the podcast, which is amazing, and we do really, really appreciate it. But part of the mission with this is to get more and more people listening and watching and reading all the things that we're suggesting. And the best way to do that is actually to do your review on iTunes.
So not to witter on about how you should do things for us, but if you'd like to, leave us an iTunes review. It'll make us happy. Happy Christmas to all, a good night. Anyway, so the first thing we're going to talk about this week is a slightly odd one for us, but we've both listened to three albums. And we're going to talk about all three of those albums, aren't we?
They've all been out relatively recently.
Yeah, this year.
This year, a couple of them actually quite recently. The three artists all have some things in common. They're all kind of female solo artists who do kind of interesting and experimental things.
Yeah.
So they are Joanna Newsom, Bjork and Grimes.
And the album, so we've got Joanna Newsom's Divers, Bjork's, I'm going to say this wrong, I'm sure, Vulnicura?
I don't know, I've not heard anyone say it out loud.
Vulnicura? I don't know. Anyway, it's probably a mythology thing, isn't it, that I should know about that I don't know about. And Grimes's Art Angels.
Yes.
I actually have a quote from Grimes here, which I thought might be interesting to read, which like really blows this whole thing back in our face a bit. So in the interests of, you know, not being biased, here she says on her Tumblr in February of 2014, I think. So there's some language in this, guys. Go with it. I hate it when people compare me to Bjork. Not because I don't completely love Bjork and think that she's a fucking badass, but because it just seems like lazy journalism.
Sorry.
I.e., any female artist who makes even remotely experimental music is constantly compared to Bjork by journalists who completely ignore the legacy of every other experimental female musician who isn't Bjork. Also, good luck ever being likened to a male musician. The media seems to think you can only be similar to musicians who have the same sex organs as you. I actually don't really see the point in comparing artists all the time, but whatever. So, I mean, we're gonna... Sorry, Grimes. Ah, we're hurting your feelings. It feels bad.
Also, Bjork is a really, really big deal.
Yeah, and we love Bjork.
And I wasn't... Actually, I didn't fully appreciate this until I was in New York in March of this year, and I was going to MoMA just to have a look around, to like kill some time before I was meeting my friend. And there was a Bjork exhibition that had just opened there, kind of in the style of the big David Bowie one that they had at the VMA here. You know, like a kind of appreciation of her as like a kind of multi-disciplined artist and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the queue for it was like out the door. It was on like the second floor and people were queuing out onto the street. It was a massive big deal. And I mentioned it to my friend. I was like, wow, that Bjork exhibition. She was like, oh my God, everyone won't shut up about it. Like it's the biggest thing happened in New York.
It doesn't
right now.
Surprise me really, but sometimes you do forget, don't you? But I think also something that is interesting is like these artists don't actually have that much in common.
No.
But what unites them weirdly is their like difference. And I think that's why people instinctively want to compare these kinds of musicians, you know, like Joanna Newsom, like Bjork, like Grimes, even though that they know that they aren't actually that similar, because what they're saying is, here are three women who are like breaking out of, you know, certain constructs and musical confines and doing it really well. And isn't that interesting to think about?
And I also think that partly what Grimes overlooks maybe in that quote is that I like all three of these artists. So I got into Joanna Newsom first of the three and through that kind of found things that I liked about the other two.
Mm.
And I think I'm probably not alone in that I think there's probably a lot of crossover between their fans. And that's because I like all those things you just said, and they are, all three of them, whilst not kind of particularly unified in their musical style, they are definitely like women who stand outside of the kind of mainstream. I don't think any of their fans are comparing them. They're just all appreciating all of them.
Yeah, for their individual difference. It's funny because I've also got something that Joanna Newsom said in an interview with one of our favourites, Tarvi Gevinson, over at Rookie. And Tarvi was asking her about people she likes, and she said, I'm really excited by the way that Grimes frames herself and seems utterly disinterested in her own beauty, which is really exciting to me. Sometimes it's useful for an idea, and then other times it's not useful for an idea, and she seems unaffected either way. I like her music as well. I like what she says. And that's something that I think all these three artists do, is that they sort of project all these different versions of themselves as a way of breaking out from the kind of self that you're Bjork, expected to be.
Let us not forget, Bjork once went to an award ceremony dressed as a swan.
Yeah.
And not like dressed as a swan, like with a swan on her.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's like something that's really interesting and actually comes through in all these three albums, is this idea that there can be lots of different versions of you, and what does it mean to let go of old versions of you or embrace new versions of you. And I think, you know, there's Joanna Newsom sort of, and she doesn't directly compare herself to Grimes in that quote, but she is saying like, oh yeah, I like the way she frames herself. And I think there must be a recognition on some level that Joanna Newsom likes that, because she kind of does something similar herself.
Yeah. So let's talk a bit about the music.
Yeah.
Maybe if we take the Joanna Newsom album first.
Yeah.
This was actually my favourite.
Me, mine
of
too.
The three.
Yeah, I love Joanna Newsom, so I'm a bit biased.
Same. I worried actually when I was doing my listening whether, you know, I could have said that sentence before I listened to any of them.
Yeah.
And it still would have been
true.
Yeah,
maybe it's,
you know,
a self-fulfilling prophecy in a sense.
Because, yeah, I do totally love her. If you don't know her, she is a sort of harpist / singer-songwriter.
She's got a real background in classical training, hasn't she?
She does. I mean, I rank her up there with, there's another sort of folky artist called Seth Lakeman, who he plays the violin and sings at the same time.
Right.
And he and Joanna Newsom, am I like, I just don't know how you do that. Like, I just can't see how.
But sometimes I say that kind of stuff to you where I'm like, I don't know how singers do this. And you're like, literally, it's the most natural thing in the world. And I'm
yeah,
like,
but
okay.
I play the violin. I have played the harp. I definitely couldn't sing at the same time.
Yeah. No, it does seem like there's a whole lot of, you know, different brain processes that have to be completely simultaneous and natural.
I just don't know how she does it. She's made, as you say, she's made lots of different kinds of music. I personally identify most closely with the stuff that I think is on her second album.
Is that Wise?
Yes. Mm. Which is these long, like 8-9 minute songs, some of them, lots of like really big swooping sounds, and the lyrics are like more like poems than lyrics. They're like long narrative verses that like tell a story about a thing.
Yeah.
With lots of different musical ideas. You know, there's not really a kind of verse chorus structure a lot of the time.
No.
And that's my absolute favourite stuff of hers.
Yeah, and this album's quite different to those albums in a way, isn't it? Like the songs are shorter, and it's just, I mean, for me, this album felt quite unified musically. I don't know what you think.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think she's worked quite a lot on her voice, it sounds like. Because one of the things that is particularly apparent in her first album is that she has a very distinctive vocal tone, and she quite likes like yelps and kind of squeaks and stuff. And I always wondered the extent to which that was deliberate or whether that was just the noises that came out.
Yeah.
I get the feeling that she's worked a lot on her kind of control, because in this album she does do all those noises, but in a way that you think like that's exactly when she wants that to sound like that.
Yeah. I read somewhere that because of her classical background, she didn't feel like she could sing for a long time.
Mm.
She was like, you know, the way that I was trained to sort of look at it was you play the harp for 20 years and then you can start recording playing the harp once you've done that. And because she wasn't someone who'd been singing in the same way that she'd been playing the harp, it took a long time for her to be like, actually, you know, I could just give this a go. I think she came to this stuff fairly late, I think, compared to, you know, a lot of the kind of like 16-year-old pop stars you get, like someone like Grimes, obviously, who like started doing this stuff much younger. So yeah, I think it's funny how she had to like, because it seems so instinctive and natural with her, but she had to like force herself to embrace that side of her music, I guess.
Mm. Yeah, she's also, I saw her live once at, I think it was the Latitude Festival, and it was really funny because me and my friend Nicola were so excited to see her. She was basically the reason we got into the festival. Mm. But she was playing at like midday on the main stage.
Oh yeah.
So there was almost no one else there, and those people who were there were all like lying on the floor still hungover
from the
night before.
That's like when I went
to
see Leanne LaHavis this year.
And so she had like a kind of string orchestra with her, but it was mostly just like her at the front playing her harp. A couple of times she got halfway through one of her really long songs and she was like, oh no, I've done it wrong. And she'd like skip back four lines and be like, I'm going to try that again. And
oh,
then,
bless.
So she's obviously still very, very conscious and not feeling like I'm the singer that I can just like riff it, you know.
One of the other things that I thought was interesting about this album, I can't claim that this is my own thought. I read a really interesting piece in Slate about the fact that she hasn't got a picture of herself on the cover art, and it's normally a portrait of her in some way. Yeah, again, in this interview for Rookie, she talked about it, I've always claimed in the past that my album covers are portraits of the narrator of the record. The narrator of the record is me usually, but me with a certain aspect really concentrated or exaggerated. Other aspects are removed because they're not relevant to the record. It's a stylized version of me every time. She says, that narrator is also housed within some framework that hints or points towards the vibe, the mood, or the feel of the record. This album cover is no different. So she's actually not explained it at all, other than to say, like, these are all portraits of me, and this one without my face is no different.
Yeah.
Which is quite interesting. And anyway, this writer in Slate compared it to, you know, the Ferrante novels.
Yeah.
And how everyone's like, oh, the covers are shit, because they're, like, really tacky.
They make
really
them look sort of chiclety.
Yeah. And he thinks that basically because both these female artists are engaged in like contradicting supposed ideas about like women's roles and stuff like that, that they're like playing a game with you. So they've got these quite twee, pretty covers. And actually the whole point is that the cover might not be what you expect or match up to your expectations of what's inside. There's a line in Divers where she says, I know we must abide each by the rules that bind us here, the divers and the sailors and the women on the pier. Because obviously the sort of narrative in that song is that she wants to marry the diver and she's the diver's wife and she kind of has to wait on the pier for him to come back up.
Yeah.
What did you think of Bjork's album?
It was very Bjorky. Yeah. That sounds really facile. But it had...
What is Bjorky? Because it's like quite hard to pin down Bjorkiness because her music varies so
much. Yeah, I guess quite heavily electronic.
Yeah.
Really demanding and difficult vocal lines. Unexpected use of sound. So like, I'm thinking of, you know, there've been times when she's used like an entire big band in a song. And then other times where she's like only used multi-tracked versions of her own voice and stuff, you know. So I suppose whilst it's all new material, I didn't find it surprising particularly in any way. Like it felt aesthetically of a piece of what I know of her work before.
Yeah. I felt like there was a lot of variation between individual songs as well on this one. I don't know if you felt that too, but I felt like it sort of jumped around and hopped around a bit more. I also found that a lot with Grimes's, like that there wasn't a genre that I would be like, oh yeah, this Grimes album is in this genre. Mm. I mean, I guess I wouldn't for any of them, but especially with Grimes.
I felt with her, I got the really strong sense of like maybe 3 different musical personalities in it.
Going on at once.
Because it felt like there was maybe 3 or 4 songs on the album that worked together as a group, spread out across the track listing. So that was quite nice, actually, because it meant that like you got one song like in one kind of mode, and then you got another one, and you're like, oh yeah, that's like that one we had before, and yeah.
Did you have like a standout track on the album or on any of these albums?
I really liked the Grimes song that she does with
Janelle Monáe.
Yeah,
me too.
Yeah, that was
Venus
fine.
Fly.
Yeah, that was my favourite
I really
one.
Liked that one too. That's like the banger on the album, isn't it? That's the one that you could imagine going out and hearing come on.
Yeah, that one was really good. I like the whole thing, really. I listened to it on Spotify, but I'm definitely going
to
buy it.
I think I need to listen to it some more to get into it, because it's not. I wouldn't be like, yeah, what an amazingly accessible album, necessarily. Though again, probably wouldn't say that about any of these, but I think they're all really worth the time and investment. I mean, I would say especially the Joanna Newsom one, which is maybe my favourite of hers.
Yeah. Oh, no, it's definitely not my favourite Joanna Newsom album yet. But they're very much
I see
growers.
Some potential.
I see potential. I definitely, at the time of speaking, her second album is my favourite, and her first one is my second favourite, so this one is currently third.
Okay. Well, listeners, report back with your own Joanna Newsom pyramids of enjoyment.
It's very important, you know, not to sound like Nick Hornby or anything, but like it's very important to like have a ranking of these things in your head.
If we could all get some lists going, that would be great.
Yeah.
One thing that did get me into the festive spirit, surprisingly, was Carol, the Todd Haynes movie that Caroline and I went to see together on last Tuesday.
Yes, we went to a special preview screening with a Q&A with the director, which we will talk a bit more about in a minute. The film, I think, is just out released, isn't it?
I think it came out on Friday.
And you've probably seen some of the press for it. It stars Cate Blanchett and Rooney Mara. It's an adaptation of a Patricia Highsmith novel, and it's a lesbian drama. I suppose that's the thing that's getting quite a lot.
It has to have that name.
It's also, I think, and I'm no film industry expert, but it's very clearly headed for the Oscars.
What's your name?
Therese.
Therese Balivant.
And yours?
Carol.
So Rooney Mara's character Therese is working in a shop a bit like Eilish in Brooklyn.
Yeah, it's actually very similar because it's set in 1953.
Yeah.
Which is almost exactly when Brooklyn
isn't it? It's definitely early 50s anyway.
So Therese works in this big department store that apparently Patricia Highsmith, who wrote the book, also
actually worked in
one. She worked in Bloomingdale's. So this is, I can't remember the name of the shop in the film, but it's meant to be Bloomingdale's.
It's called something really silly like
Frankenberg's or something like that. Yeah, so it's this big department store in Manhattan, and she works on the doll floor.
Yeah, it's getting up to the holidays, and she's got a Santa hat on at work, and there are all these like nice train sets, and basically she meets Cate Blanchett's character Carol when Carol comes in to buy a Christmas present for her daughter.
It's as simple as that, really. Like Carol accidentally leaves her gloves behind on the counter, and since she's posting the present that she's bought for her daughter anyway, Therese makes sure to include the gloves in a note, and like she gets back to her and they go for lunch, and their relationship just sort of grows from there.
They have an immediate chemistry, don't they, from the moment Carol walks into the shop. Before they even speak, there's a real sense that there's like, oh, who's that magnetic woman stood over there? And she kind of stood behind a glass. The train set is in this glass display box, and she's sort of partially obscured by it. And then some people walk past, and then she sort of disappears. And that sort of begins a theme in the film about, you know, trying to pin down a view of Carol as a human.
Yeah.
In the Q&A that we went to, Todd Haynes explained that he had a book, an image book, filled with visual references for this film. And what it didn't have a lot of was that sort of like glamorous 50s Hollywood era type image, because it just didn't seem appropriate, because they wanted the realness, the reality of the story to come through.
And it really challenges this idea that I think we're all sort of guilty of, is believing that the 50s began in 1950. The 50s capital F began in, just as the 60s capital F
started in 1960.
And of course, time and fashion and trend don't move like that. That actually, the idea of the 50s as we think of it now, so all like women in big skirts and bright colours and men in sort of zoot suits and stuff, none of that really happened. Well, it all happened at different paces in different places. And if you were someone who worked in a shop in New York City in 1953, you did not wear umpteen petticoats and skirts that had 6 meters of material in them.
Yeah, though Carol, of course, is a figure of considerable glamour.
She is very wealthy and thus stands out in the kind of slight drabness of Therese's life, in her kind of beautiful coats and her sort of lovely hats and her like amazing dresses. But quite a lot of her fashion looked to me like it was almost a bit 20s inspired.
I and 40s as well. Yeah. I mean she just looks amazing, doesn't she? And she's just such a brilliant actress. Carol really performs the part of like this glamorous image, and as the film goes on and as you get to know her better and as the relationship deepens, has to come through in the performance, in Cate Blanchett's performance. She has an amazing gait and an amazing, you know, just way of being that seems so glamorous, and she softens that performance as the film goes on in a really clever way.
Carol is Therese's sort of like first human subject. You know, up until that point she's only been taking like landscapes and pictures of things she sees on the street and stuff. Part of her kind of growing interest and attraction to Carol is the fact that she wants to photograph her, that she wants to capture her. We see more and more of this. One of the great big motifs of the film is looking through windows, like looking round things, sort of reflections and so on. And it's all Absolutely. About trying to kind of see the essence of who this woman is. She becomes very self-reliant.
Yeah.
And you get the feeling that right at the beginning of the film that she's always been self-reliant in a kind of financial and physical way, like she lives on her own and looks after herself and so on. But she's not necessarily that emotionally self-reliant. Like, she has this boyfriend who she doesn't really like him, but she hangs out.
Shout out to Plop from The Office. Yep. And also Obvious Child.
She hangs out with him and his friends because it just seems like the kind of thing that someone like her would do.
Yeah.
She doesn't really start questioning whether she actually wants to until she meets Carol.
Yeah.
She knows that, you know, he wants to marry her and like go to Europe with her and all this kind of stuff. And she knows that she doesn't really want to, but she also doesn't feel self-confident enough to say why not.
There's also a sense that, you know, saying, oh, she hangs out with these people because it's something someone like her would do. There's also this running idea when she speaks to her, you know, boyfriend who becomes ex-boyfriend and people like that, that a girl like her does not have a lesbian relationship.
Yes.
And that's obviously structurally important to the plot, is the taboo surrounding lesbian relationships, because it's what prevents the characters from fully being together, in a sense. That's where the tension of the film comes from. That's the driving force behind it. But it never, ever, as Todd Haynes said in the Q&A we went to, it's not an issues film. It never feels like this is a film about being a lesbian at this time. It's not.
No.
It's so much more subtle than that, isn't it? And so much more about treating people as like just two people who want to be in a relationship, and not being like, what does this mean for everyone else in the world who's gay?
And a lot of the obstacles that are there to their relationship come from Carol's ex-husband.
Mm.
And you get the feeling that he's got this combination of this possessive obsession with her, and also this idea that he needs her in order to live the kind of life he wants to live. Like, he needs the capable, beautiful wife because on his arm, because he's a successful businessman.
Yeah,
so
definitely.
He needs her for what she looks like and what she behaves like.
And there is a weird sense that without that, they might have actually been, you know,
they might have been fine.
There might have been no drama.
Yeah. But you get the sense that it doesn't matter who Carol wants to be with instead of him. The point is that she wants to be with anyone else who isn't him.
Yeah. I think we should start an ongoing podcast just called, like, Misleading Trailers.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Such a misleading trailer.
Yeah. Well, I actually loved the trailer for this film, but one of the most interesting things about this film is its lack of emotional dialogue.
Mm.
There's barely any. I mean, the relationship between Therese and Carol goes completely verbally unacknowledged between them. They both, you know, she's saying, would you like to go on a road trip with me? And Therese says yes. And that obviously means something. And they both know that means something. And they both know that that probably means she's going to break up with her boyfriend before she comes. But like, everything's really delayed. It's not, you know, it's not a film that sees these two people have sex immediately by any means. It's like everything's very slow and very gentle in that sense. And they never really say, like, oh yeah, I love being with you. You know, there's no verbal exchanges about their relationships, which makes it a very difficult film to make a trailer for.
For the trailer, they had to use bits of dialogue that other people say about them.
Yeah, and bits of dialogue taken from completely other relationships in their lives. So, for example, there's an ongoing plot about Carol's daughter and her husband's daughter, and they take a lot of dialogue from that plot for the trailer where she's like, we gave each other life's greatest gift, and she means a child. And in the trailer, obviously, sounds like she's talking to Therese about their relationship. But that was one of the things that I found difficult about this film, because I loved the film, but I found it difficult to know what my emotions were watching it. It's not like some of the other big Oscar-winning, grand, lush love stories where, you know, your heart's in your throat and you're swallowing and trying to hold back the tears as they, you know, declare their undying love for each other outside a nice Regency National Trust house. it's not like that at all. I was like, I didn't cry in this film, and I cry at everything. It's not emotionally dramatic. And when I was watching it, I thought that meant that I wasn't invested in it. But the fact that I've kept thinking about it since we saw it probably proves to me that I am invested in it. So I think that's quite a clever...
It is very clever, and I think it's also...
So yeah, this isn't a film that wears its heart on its sleeve at all, even though it is, you know, the big romance of the moment. I'd love to see it again, actually, I think.
I was thinking about going to see it again as well, actually. And just because I want to pay more attention to the music, and there are whole lots of things that I feel like I didn't pay enough attention to the first time.
Before we end on this, we should say, I think, a little bit more about the Q&A that we went
to,
which was fantastic. I have been to a lot of Q&As for this kind of thing, and I always find directors and you know, people who've made films disappointing. I feel like sometimes I'm like, oh, you made this amazing film, and you don't sound very like you're talking about this very intelligently. Like, people always act as though everything either was a bit of an accident, nothing to do with them, or they speak as though, you know, it was completely their vision and their vision alone that made everything brilliant. And Todd Haynes was so clear that this was a collaborative film and a collaborative effort, but he was also very clearly able to talk about what he had in mind for the film and what his influences were in a really articulate, really interesting, engaging way that wasn't at all arrogant, and I actually made me love the film even more.
Yeah, same here. And also the fact that he didn't make any apology for the fact that he, as a male director, had made this entirely woman-centric film. But he also just... made no point of this, but he was constantly referencing, like, the female screenwriters and the female producers and the female designers and all of the women who'd worked, and the actresses, obviously, all of the women who he'd worked with on the film.
Yeah, and the fact that it's, you know, a film about female experience. Yeah. And, yeah, people like the producer who was sat next to us in the screening, he kept name-checking all her efforts and involvement and everything. I don't know who this person was, but the sort of location hunter and set designer who took them. This whole film is filmed in Cincinnati, even though it's set in New York, and they found some really interesting places in Cincinnati that had loads of period details.
So he made it really clear that it was a total collaborative effort.
Yeah.
It's like majority women in the named roles in the crew, which I just don't believe that happens very often. But he was name-checking all these people and making clear it was a collaboration, but not doing that really obnoxious thing of being like, yeah, the film is really great, but, you know, it was like a team effort.
Yeah.
He was actually saying, so, like you say, like, so-and-so is our location manager, and she was instrumental to the film being how it is in these ways.
Yeah, exactly. And also, obviously, this is a novel written by a woman about women's experience. One of the things we both found really interesting from the Q&A was the amount he talked about contemporary photographers from that time. And he did repeatedly say that the people who were perhaps most influential in getting them to try and create this vision of a 1950s New York that was more real, was less like the 1950s New York we tend to see on screen, were the female photojournalists at the time who were documenting a sort of city that he called it like dirty and sagging.
Yeah.
And that... You know, so that's like Ruth Orkin, Helen Levitt, Esther Bubbly or Boobly, I don't know. And that really struck a chord with me, that he was like, you know what, this is a film about women in this environment, and let's look back at what the women at the time were sort of saying about this period through their artwork.
Particularly since one of the women characters in the film is a photographer, it just makes total sense to get as close to her experience as you can.
Exactly. So I was really impressed with how he spoke about it, and it gave me a whole new appreciation of the film, which I'm really excited to see again, I think, and would recommend everyone go and see it.
Absolutely. And actually, I think I'm going to go and try and watch some more Todd Haynes movies now
Yeah, me too. I mean, I don't know. Is this the one that everyone's being like, yeah, this is his best?
I'm not sure, to be honest. I knew that he made that Mildred Pierce series for HBO, although I haven't seen it. And I knew that it was supposed to be very good. But I'm not massively aware of his output generally.
I want to go and read a Patricia Highsmith novel. That too, I've never read any. That's probably next for me.
No.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
So last week I recommended Anna the web series X-Best, which is a little drama about, in sort of 4 or 5 minute episodes.
Yeah, they're very short.
Two women who were formerly best friends and now aren't anymore. And it's about the fallout from their friendship breakup. Anna, what did you make of it?
Oh, it's an odd one because it's funny, but I'm also really sad when I watch it. So, I mean, they're not very clear on why they fell out, are they? They went on holiday together for work. They went to Iceland together for 7 days. I think it's Iceland.
Yeah.
They were trapped in the hotel with each other all the time because it was just dark all the time outside and they had nothing to do and it was cold. But there's not like one major argument. One of the girls says, oh, you know that thing she does? That awful thing with the talking? Yeah. That's basically all you get of like why they actually fell out.
You have been known to overreact.
You weren't there. We are completely different people. And that thing, the thing she does with her talking, I don't know how she lives in this world.
Which is odd for me because I have some really, you know, close female friendships and I know that if we did have one of these, like, dramatic, if they became an ex-best, it would be because of a very particular, you know, big argument. I don't think it would just be because we started finding each other really annoying. I don't think that's necessarily enough to tip you over the edge in these
kinds
of... Yeah,
the sense I sort of got to by the end of this is that they just spend too much time together.
Yeah.
Because they work together. They seem to have all the same mutual friends. And they just spent a whole week's holiday with each other. So I sort of wondered whether it was just, in this case, it was cumulative.
Maybe. Basically, you've summed up what the drama is about, is that they, like, have to keep seeing each other every day. It seems like, because they work together and they have all the same friends and, yeah, it's just all a bit much. For me, if you're going to break up with a friend, pick someone you're not going to see every day.
Yeah.
That was my advice.
I think that's the problem. I sort of feel like they would have, since there doesn't seem to be a kind of instigating incident, if they didn't have to see each other every day, if they could have just not spoken for 2 weeks afterwards,
maybe
they would have got over it. Yeah. But it's, and obviously this is where the tension and the drama comes from, the fact that they do have to see each other every day, that means that there's no opportunity to sort of forgive.
Yeah.
And there's the kind of constant little retaliations and office harms they do each other.
Yeah, the office is really funny. They work at this office called Behold, like the company's called like Behold. And they, like, it's really unclear what it does, but they like have channels and they're like, you can do the Be Free channel and the Be Loved channel.
It's sort of like Pinterest. I think yeah. It's like Pinterest, but for like aspirational yuppies. It's awful.
Yeah, and one of the two girls sits on like what's that called? Like an exercise ball.
Oh, it's like, so annoying.
And like bouncing up and down all day. Well, she's at work and it looks so annoying. And she's like eating yogurts and watching videos of pugs all day on her little thing. And then when someone comes over to tell her to do some work, she wears a headset and she like just taps the ear on the headset as if to be like, I'm in a call, when she's just not.
She's
which
just
is like, what a great idea. Like maybe I should just buy a headset and at work be like, sorry, busy. Basically, it's that classic kind of, and I feel like I have been in these situations before where like I'll have had like a violent falling out with one of my best friends and then someone else will be like, oh, you know, how's Clara? And I'll be like, yeah, she's really good. And that, yeah, she's loving her life. And I'll be like, oh my God, I don't want to talk about her right now. She's so annoying and I hate her. So there's a lot of that where like, for example, one of the girls' boyfriend's friend is dating the other girl in the friendship. And he's like, so, you know, what's she like? Give me the... She's like, obviously she's really pretty. And he's like, yeah, but what is she like? He's sort of like, she's just like eating this bag of popcorn. She like just doesn't know what to say at all. She's like, she's got a really, really strong sense of self.
Yeah, she can't think of anything nice to say.
And all that stuff is like really funny to me. Mm. And then there's a whole nother sort of thread where they're just trying to get on with the rest of their lives, basically. Yeah. And like, you know, embarrassing things keep happening, like they get shut in cupboards and that kind of stuff. It could be any sort of millennial New York based show.
I definitely see it existing in that kind of space with Girls and Broad City and Obvious Child, all that we've talked about before. Kind of like young women trying to sort out adult life in New York.
Yeah. And I think for me, the stronger bits are the bit about the having the friendship end.
Yeah.
And having to deal with that. And like, even just like, for example, the bit where she cried about it in the very first episode, one of them just like cries about it to her boyfriend and is like, can't put her phone down even as he's like trying to have sex with her because she's like, is she just never going to speak to me again? Is this what my life's going to be like now? We're just never going to text. That stuff is, I feel like, maybe not so common. I think the stuff that was original about it was the best stuff, basically.
Yes.
And those were those little bits which were like actually a glimpse of what happens if you do lose someone who's really dear to you, who's not someone that you're having sex with.
Yeah, and it's like being in a sort of relationship breakup where, like many things about relationships now, all the different channels of communication that you have just make it... Oh, there's a really good line actually that Tina Fey has in 30 Rock about this, where she's got like a teenager in her office to help her with some reason. And this teenager is doing this monologue about how, you know, like, I mean, I poked him on Facebook, but like, he didn't poke me back. And then I sent him a WhatsApp. But then also, like, I commented on something on Instagram. And like, she's laying out all the different ways. And Tina Fey just interrupts and she's like, oh my God, there are just so many ways for boys to ignore you now.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how you feel these girls are in the situation.
Yeah.
Like, not only do they work in each other's presence every day.
Not only do they have to ignore each other in the work
bathroom. Yeah, they have all of these open channels of communication that are now closed
and
off.
Mutual friends. Yeah. Like they're not even all digital channels of communication, but like there are so many of them. So I watched the first six, I think, and I'm definitely going to watch the other half of the series.
Yeah, I think there's 12 or 13 altogether.
Yeah.
You can, it's basically like just over an hour of television altogether.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm going to finish watching it because I'm curious as to how it goes. And I think it's a mixed bag. And I would, and also in general, I would love to see more stuff on TV about like properly breaking up with a friend. Because they kind of do it in Girls, but you always know in Girls that they're going to get back together in a weird way.
Because that's the sort of premise of the
show.
Yeah,
and it does work best when they're all like seeing each other regularly on that show. I get bored when like that we're just literally following each of their individual plot lines and they're not communicating with each other.
Yeah.
I did find that boring. But I think, you know, it's easy to slide into stereotypes here and be like, women can be really bitchy. But I do think female friendships can tend toward intensity compared to male friendships. And I think it's often that's just celebrated and like talked about all the nice aspects of that. But that can be really difficult too, because you have to put loads of effort into your friendships if they're really close.
I don't believe that this really happens with boys, particularly at school age. But I had this thing happen to me when I think I was 14 in year 9. Mm. And at the time I was hanging out with 4 other girls and we were like a group of 5. And we were always a 5. We did everything together. And then one day I just came into school and one of the girls was just not speaking to me. And she did not speak to me for the next 4 years.
Jesus.
And, you know, for like 3 weeks, I like obsessively asked everyone.
Are you sure you didn't murder a pet whilst in a trance or something?
That is, eventually I had to come to the conclusion that I'd done something dreadful.
Really terrible.
And had like blotted out all memory of it.
Repressed it.
But this is the thing that like, that's the bad side of the intensity of female friendships, that, yeah, the intensity of liking also can become an intensity of disliking.
Yeah, and also sometimes I've had situations with a friend where it's been like, you know what, we really love each other, but we actually just can't be friends, and it is like a relationship breakup. Mm. It's like, oh, you know, I obviously was attracted to you, and we obviously had loads of fun together, but there's just like something, there's an inherent obstacle here we're not going to get over, so it's probably best if we just part ways.
Mm.
And that's like not something anyone is ever encouraged to do.
No.
Or like, I mean, maybe it's not a good thing to do, who knows, but I'm sure it does happen for a lot of people, and that means it's something that we should look at on telly.
Mm.
So
yeah.
I applaud the premise of the show, definitely, and I'd be really interested to see where else it could go in, you know, in a longer form and that kind of thing, where it does, is able to give more space to that one plot line.
Yeah, so we'll put a link to all the videos in the show notes, and also if you have experiences or perspectives on this kind of breakups,
we
would like to know, because I just don't think it's something that gets talked about that all that much, so it would be nice to know what your experiences
yeah
are.
Especially as well if there are other programs that you can deal with as well.
Yeah,
I'd like to see that, where it doesn't end with them all crying and hugging and becoming best friends again.
Yeah.
Thanks. So, Caroline, for you, as a recommend, I would like to give you what I think is currently the best TV show on UK television. It's on BBC4, weirdly, because that's not normally where I get my kicks, but sure. And it's called Detectorists, and it's a comedy, a sitcom, about 2 detectorists, which are people who go around with metal detectors looking for treasure. It's Toby Jones and Mackenzie Crook as 2 best friends who go out with their metal detectors. They're very keen to let you know that the name of someone who uses a metal detector is not a detector, but a detectorist, hence the title of the programme. And they are both part of like a local detectorist club, and they go out all the time and they're trying to find some stuff that they think there's like an Anglo-Saxon, you know, like burial site or something beneath one of the hills. And yeah, I think it's really funny, but it's like obviously not like a kind of crass or laugh out loud necessarily, you know, in your face humour. It's a gentle humour. But we're fans of a gentle humour, aren't
yeah.
we? So I think you'll enjoy it.
Yeah, I look forward to it.
Thanks for listening to Seriously, the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman.
We have a special request of our listeners. We are turning our thoughts to Christmas, and we want to do a special episode all about Christmas television, how you watch it, what you enjoy, and so on. So we would like to hear from you. All our contact details can be found on newstatesman.com/SRSLY. Please get in touch.
So, Caroline.
Yes. Oh, sorry, I'm listening.
Sorry, we're recording. Well, you're on a podcast right now. I don't know if you realise.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.